This sermon was delivered at Grand Avenue Baptist Church, a gospel-centered church in Ames, Iowa. Hear more sermons and learn more about Grand Avenue at gabcames.org.
Okay, let's jump into it. So today we are continuing our approach on the topic of apologetics. This is our second week, if you remember the chart we had the last couple of weeks, this is our second week in the so-called presuppositional category. Basically, this is the approach to apologetics where we're kind of taking a broadside approach at a worldview as a whole. We're kind of saying, how can we compare, just kind of taking top to bottom, the secular worldview and the Christian worldview, and how can we just kind of compare them really at an intuitive level of what just makes the most sense of kind of some of our most fundamental human commitments of what it means to be human and just the experience of human life. So first, I want to give a few caveats on this one. This will be probably by a wide margin our most kind of difficult and just. This is going to be a challenging lesson, just to be upfront with you. There's just a lot that needs to be said, a lot of terms and ideas that need to get thrown in. So this just upfront, this is going to be a bit of a sprint. With that, to some degree, in something like apologetics, and often just in life, difficulty and potency tend to go hand in hand. Difficulty and potency tend to scale together. So the more difficult something is, kind of the more payoff there tends to be for it. Something that's going to be easy is often going to have less of a reward for it. And for some reason, these topics of apologetics that we're going to be covering, presuppositional, deductive, and inductive approaches to apologetics, tend to kind of have this inverse relationship of kind of what's the easiest to understand versus what's the most compelling. Right, so in this lesson, it's going to be the most challenging. But kind of if once these things start to click with you, there's going to be this force under them that will just make the Christian worldview just obvious and just have this compelling force behind it. Whereas some of the later stuff, we'll look at some of fine tuning of the universe and just some interesting facts and details about the way God created the world that will be a little bit easier to understand. Oh, I can understand if that value is different, life doesn't work on earth. That kind of makes a good sense. And yet it doesn't have the kind of punch that some of the other approaches might have. So there's a certain tether between difficulty and potency. So we need to talk about the difficult things just because those are going to be the things that are going to lay a firmer foundation for you in this topic. Second, yeah, my hope isn't to give you a kind of a thorough understanding on all these topics, but in a lot of these things will probably be the first time you're hearing some of these terms, some of these concepts. So part of my hope is that over time, this will start to give you some hooks to hang things on, some data points to kind of build around. That you might not see the connections, the interconnections, the relationships right away, but that as you continue to learn, continue to grow, continue to think about some of these things, you just have some pegs that you can start to build a system around. And third, I want to dig into the hard stuff. One, because I believe you can do it. And two, because I want to help you see that you can do it. So some of these topics are difficult to grasp. Some of these topics will take a good bit of work for you to kind of internalize and be able to apply. But you can do that. I think you have what it takes to challenge yourself in some of these spaces. So I want to just be the one to invite you into that. So that's what I want to do. Although one other thing I do want to say, we're, if we have time, going to be spending a good bit of time kind of staring into the void today. So I was kind of working through this and it just kind of clicked with me of this actually might be fairly difficult for people to think about, not just intellectually challenging, but just kind of a kind of getting queasy in the stomach kind of a thing. So if you need to step out, need to kind of not be thinking about this, don't feel shame. There's some staring into the void that we will need to do. Okay, so recapping last week a little bit, this week and last week go together. Last week was kind of more or less the kind of high-level idea, the big concept. If this makes any sense to you, you can think of last week as kind of like the press conference before the big, you know, MMA pay-per-view fight, right? It was basically just the big kind of the trash-talking session of here's why secularism is ridiculous, and here's, you know, kind of the high-level, right? Basically just trash talk. But this is where we're actually going to have the fight. Right, this is we're going to get into the ring, and we're kind of going to get into some of the details. These two are kind of related to each other. Last week was again big picture, and then this week is going to try to put it on the ground a little bit to kind of dig into some of the details. So big idea of last week, basically made the point looking at, remember Oz Guinness, I have some books up here that if you want to go a little bit deeper, I have some recommendations for you. Come talk to me afterwards if you want to ask about some of those. One of those is talked about last week, Oz Guinness, his Fool's Talk. He gives this really helpful illustration of how in a secular worldview, somebody embraces a secular worldview, they're going to functionally live kind of in a tension between two poles, right? Basically, the tension between consistency to their worldview of secularism and consistency to the world as it really is, God's real world. Right, and so that's more or less what we're trying to do, is to help people see that there are certain things that you are committed to about what it means to be human. And secularism rejects all of those. And so Guinness makes the point that someone is either living inconsistent with real human life in what he calls the dilemma pole, or is living inconsistent with their worldview and living in the real world. So there's the dilemma pole and there's the diversion pole. Basically, I affirm secularism, but I kind of distract myself so that I don't have to think about it and still live in the basically the Christian world where we'll get into some of the implications of that. Or there's the inhuman pole and the incoherent pole. Those are the blanks there. Inhuman pole, basically the denial of humanity, and incoherent pole where you live in a way that's just inconsistent with your worldview. Okay, and Guinness points out again that the vast majority of people are going to live, who affirm that worldview, are going to live in the incoherence pole, right? They're going to say they affirm secularism, but they're not going to really think through the implications of that worldview. So they're still going to affirm personality, so they're going to affirm free will, so they're going to affirm morality and stuff like that. There's a small minority that are going to try to live in the inhuman pole to be consistent with their worldview. They're going to deny free will. We looked at Stephen Hawking last week. Or they're going to deny meaning in life. We looked at Bertrand Russell. We could do a few others. But it's going to be very difficult to live this way. One interesting just historical anecdote about that is two men who tried to live in that pole, tried to live in this consistent to my secular worldview pole, were two French philosophers from the 20th century called Jean-Paul Sartre and Albert Camus. And so they affirmed this secular worldview that basically there is no inherent meaning to things. Morality is at root an illusion, a power play that we kind of create as we go about through life. And there was this interesting event where basically the French were had colonial dominion over Algeria at the time, and I don't know the exact details of what was going on, but basically Sartre signed this statement condemning some behavior of the French government in Algeria, some of the ways that they were treating the Algerians, and signed this statement, you know, condemning that, saying, hey, that's bad. And Camus basically called him out and said, if our beliefs are true, what are you doing? If our beliefs are true, why are you condemning them for doing something wrong? What does wrong mean? It was this interesting place where this guy was, they wanted to live in this inhuman pole, but even then he still had to say, no, that's wrong. And Camus goes, what are you talking about? That's meaningless. What are you talking about? So it's interesting. It's an unlivable worldview, hence the title of last week's lesson. Okay, practical payoff. How do you actually use this in kind of an apologetics conversation? Just want to give a quick note on that. Again, my goal isn't to give you a script, right? This isn't first and foremost a kind of, here's a script to go and use with your non-believing friends. Hopefully you can use some of this. Hopefully this is helpful. But my hope for you is I want you to have more of a steel spine when it comes to the Christian worldview. I want you to take some of this, and even if you can't exactly articulate this, just kind of be able to go into conversation with non-believers with just this steel in your spine that just goes, maybe I can't figure it out, but somehow your worldview is just incoherent. And there's just something that I'm looking for where it's just a disconnect in the things that you are talking about. So with that, one of the helpful things will be to just kind of learn to drive a conversation and to keep it focused looking for those tensions. looking for those ways that you impress someone to, you know, somebody says, how can there be a God if all these evil things in the world are happening? All of a sudden drive there. What do you mean by evil? What do you mean by evil? On your worldview, what is evil? What is right and wrong? Right? So trying to learn to just keep focused on looking for those tensions. Okay, well, let's jump into it again. I left off last week with the five tenets of secularism. So I'm not going to dig into that because I don't think we have as much time as I would have liked for that. But basically, these are just kind of the five principles that make up, that kind of round out a secular worldview, that define a secular worldview, that are going to make some of these tensions, that will explain some of the tensions that we'll get to in a second. So let's go through them again. The first one is nominalist ontology. Nominalist ontology. Does anybody know what ontology is? What's ontology? Anybody heard that word before? Close. Is it origin? What? Yeah, nature or being. Yeah, so basically it's this idea of kind of what is the essence, what's the nature of a thing. So nominalist ontology. It means this: things don't have natures, only names. That's nominalist, comes from the Greek nomos, which just means name. Things don't have natures, only names that we ascribe to similar things. Natures, another kind of synonyms would be forms or essences or universals, only exist in the mind of the observer. The example I like to use is kind of if you're looking at a ceiling, looking at a ceiling that has the popcorn stuff on it, right? And all of a sudden you kind of notice a face in the popcorn ceiling. Right, it's not really a face; it just kind of looks like one. That's what this. There's no popcorn up there. That's not that. Right, there's no. In reality, there's no face. It just kind of looks like it. So the face there that you're seeing is just in the mind of the observer. Right. On nominalist ontology, there's no difference between the popcorn face and a human face. It only kind of exists in the mind of the observer. On a Christian perspective, on what could be called a realist perspective, that there really is a face. There's a difference in kind between a human face and a popcorn ceiling face. So realist ontology, kind of the opposite, reduces things to form and matter. Form and matter. Nominalist ontology reduces things to matter only. There's just matter. There's no kind of essence. There's no nature. There's no universal. So form is the intelligible part. So intelligible just means the thing that you can think of. The thing that you're thinking of. Whenever you think of something, you're thinking of its form, the intelligible part. The matter is the sensible part. What you can touch, what you can smell, what you can feel. So matter is kind of what we observe in the world around us, but the form is the thing that we kind of abstract away from form and actually think about. So it's the part of the face that you see that isn't the skin cells. Again, not trying to totally dissect that. So materialist cosmology is the next blank. Materialist cosmology, that really flows out of the previous one, and that's basically saying all of reality can be reduced to matter and energy. It's almost saying the same thing, but it's a slightly different angle. All of reality can be reduced to matter and energy. So that would certainly deny form, but also spirit. And then mechanistic causality is the third one. All that exists or happens can be explained by material and efficient causes, without regard to final and formal cause, mechanistic causality. And then relativistic morality, there is no transcendent moral order. Survival and social custom are the only grounds of morality. Thus, morality is infinitely renegotiable. So here's where that idea of nominalist ontology starts to pay off a little bit. If there is such a thing as human nature, a universal, a form, an essence, if there is such a thing as human nature, then there are certain things that you must not and cannot do to things that have that nature. If there's no such thing as human nature, and there's just kind of matter that happens to be walking around, then there's no such thing as an ought and ought not. If there's no universal form of human nature, there's no universal ought not not. You starting to see that? If there's no form, then there's no kind of abstractable rules about what can and can't be done to those things. It's infinitely renegotiable at that point. Now, those are some of your blanks. If there is no human nature, that's your next blank, as a universal form, then there are no such things as human rights or human responsibilities. Then last is skeptical epistemology. Skeptical epistemology. Has anybody heard the word epistemology? What is it? How you learn? Yeah. How do you know what you know? Epistemology is just the idea of how can we kind of say that we know certain things. And so skeptical epistemology is again, this is kind of the final endpoint of this nominalist ontology. So I'll just read what I have there. Knowledge of things and causes requires a priori knowledge. Talked about that a little bit a few weeks ago. That just means beforehand knowledge, kind of knowledge of things before considered in their details. This means that we have to know something about natures of things. That's your blank. Natures of things. The forms of things, to confidently know anything about the causal relationships involved. Knowledge requires universals. So if nominalist ontology is true, if the face in the ceiling is just, if faces are just popcorn faces, then we can't actually have knowledge of things in themselves. We can only have correlation. That's your next blank. On nominalism, all knowledge is reduced to correlation. So what does that mean? You've probably heard the phrase, correlation doesn't prove causation. Right, heard that before, right? Just because X usually happens before Y, that doesn't mean that X causes Y. It just kind of correlates, right? If nominalist ontology is true, that is all knowledge. That is all knowledge, because to be able to say that X causes Y, you have to know something about the nature of X and something about the nature of Y. So an example would be a baseball bat is swung and it breaks the plane of a window and the window shatters. Kind of intuitively, you say, well, that the shattering window was caused by the bat. That's obvious. On nominalism, you actually can't say that, because there's no bat nature and window nature that you can affirm. All you can say is, well, those things are correlated. That bat happened to break the plane at the exact moment that the window shattered, but I don't actually know that it caused it. I can say that probably did, because of a correlation of experience. But because I don't know anything about bats and anything about the natures of windows, I can't actually confidently assert that. And you're looking at me like I'm crazy, which means that you're understanding what I'm saying. But this is the thing. Secular philosophy is built on that. Yes. This is Immanuel Kant. This is modern Enlightenment. Secular philosophy is completely reducible to that idea. That just because two things happen at the same time doesn't mean that you cannot say that one caused the other, because you don't know the nature of it. So all of the modern Enlightenment rejection of God hangs on the absurdity of that assertion. So hopefully you think that's ridiculous. Behind all the sophistication, all the fancy assertions of dominance, there's just this at root, just absurd denial of true knowledge. This flows out of David Hume into Immanuel Kant. And just a complete rejection of any kind of knowledge of things in themselves. And so what Kant does is he basically, so part of what Kant does is he takes, is a brilliant move. He takes the fact that we look at things and we just can't deny that there's some sense that we affirm in nature. We all know there's a difference between a human face and a popcorn face. And so what Kant says is that form, that universal, doesn't exist in the thing, it exists in your mind. It's just the structure and the shape of human thinking that gives us this perception of causation. And so because of how the human mind is structured, we think we know something about bats. We think we know something about windows. But in reality, we're just projecting. We're just projecting onto kind of an indistinguishable mass of being. So, got a little bit into the deep end there. But hopefully that's just something of an introduction. So those principles, so if somebody wanted to kind of quibble with some of those definitions, if somebody wants to say, I affirm a secular worldview, but I reject some of those things, I would just argue that if somebody disagrees with that definition of secularism, then either there's been a miscommunication, I didn't say clearly what I'm trying to say, or they didn't hear what I'm trying to say, or they don't really affirm secularism, or they just aren't as secular as they think they are. So I imagine the trouble wouldn't be with materialism or mechanism. That's just kind of the like Neil deGrasse Tyson kind of worldview. That's probably pretty much what most people think of when they think of secularism. They probably would affirm nominalism as well once they kind of wrap their heads around what we're talking about. My guess is that they would want to quibble with relativism and skepticism, But again, I would just go back to, if you affirm materialism, if you affirm mechanism, if you affirm nominalism, you have to get to relativistic morality. You have to get to skeptical ontology. And again, this is not a Christian pastor saying this. This is Immanuel Kant. This is Nietzsche saying these things. Okay, so let's jump into the impossibilities of secularism. Impossibilities of secularism. Don't pretend that I've ironed all that out. Just kind of trying to lay it out for your perusal, I suppose. Okay, here's the big idea. If secularism is true, then human life is almost entirely an illusion. That's the next blank. Almost entirely an illusion. What you think about what it means to be a human is just a deception, an illusion. We'll address four major ways that we see this, two regarding personality and two regarding meaning. We'll look at identity, freedom, meaningfulness of life, and meaningfulness of action. Okay, so the first is identity. Identity. We'll kind of cruise on this one. This is a little kind of weird. Okay, so the most basic experience of being human is a sense of self. A sense of me, a sense of self. I exist, and I know very distinctly the difference between me and not me. There's a clear difference in the world between the things that are me and the things that are not me. Here's the argument. If secularism is true, especially materialism and nominalism, then there is no unifying principle of your being. No unifying principle of your being. What is perceived to be you is reducible to physical processes that work together through time to maintain and propagate themselves. In other words, you don't exist. If secularism is true, there's no such thing as you. So do you see what I'm starting to say about kind of the potency of if this lands, you have to deny that you exist. Something like that. So clarification, obviously you are sitting there, but if secularism is true, then at base, you, what we call you, is just a collection of biological processes happening in coordination. So picture it this way. If materialism is true, imagine everything, you know, picture your model of the atom, everything being reduced to its most basic subatomic particles. What accounts for the boundary between you and your clothes? If everything is just atoms, what's the difference between you, your clothes, and everything farther away? For something to have an identity, it needs to have something that accounts for, one, its unity, and two, its distinction. It's unity and distinction. What makes you you, your unity, and what makes not you, not you, the distinction. So for the Christian and other realists, we can say, well, whatever pertains to my human nature, realism, whatever pertains to my human nature is me, and everything else is not me. Everything else is not me. My arms are me, but my shirt is not me, because it pertains to human nature to have arms. So further, that principle of unity and distinction also needs to be single, and in a limited sense, simple. The principle of unity itself needs to be single. You can't have three or four things accounting for unity. So materialism, again, fails here. A secular might say, well, the brain provides that identity. The brain is that unity and distinction principle. Whatever is directly controlled by my brain, that's me. So I could quibble about directly. What's the difference between using nerves as an intermediary and using hands as an intermediary? But more fundamentally, what's the principle of unity for your brain? Even your brain has parts. Even your brain is made up of different components that work together. So if secularism is true, there's no real distinction between you and not you. Your identity is an illusion. You can think of the unity that an organism has versus the unity that an ecosystem has. A rainforest has a certain kind of an interdependence, and your body has a certain kind of interdependence. Is there a difference in kind or just difference in degree? So the second one is freedom, free will. So after our basic awareness of ourselves, next we become aware of a certain power to choose, a certain power to choose. We can, in a limited way, act outside of the chain of cause and effect. We can act outside of the chain of cause and effect. I saw this awareness dawning in our, she would have been just under 4 months at this point, our little baby that we have. I saw this connection of her agency start to dawn on her. So around Valentine's Day, we had some balloons lying around. And so, you know, she just kind of sits there and wiggles all day long, right? And so we tied one to her foot, right? And so this balloon is just floating over her, and she's kind of like, oh, that's pretty. And all of a sudden, she moves her leg, and it moves. Like, oh, oh, oh. And it gets really startled. And then I could just start to see this connection, like, blossoming in her mind of, wait a minute, I am doing this. Amazing agency. Right. And so there's this like she's this dawning realization that I can act in the world outside of cause and effect. This is basic to the human experience. There's a way that I can impose will on the world outside of myself in a way that's not just dependent like dominoes on cause and effect. In other words, we recognize in ourselves a certain power to direct ourselves in one way and not others. When I come to a building, there are two doors to enter through. I can choose left door, right door. I can pour a bowl of Cheerios or a bowl of Rice Krispies. There's a certain choice that I can make. So here's the argument. If secularism is true, especially mechanistic causality, then your perception of free will is an illusion. Is an illusion. If secularism is true, then all of your choices are at root the result of undirected chemical and physical processes. Genetics, family upbringing, childhood trauma, your values and passions, all of this gets stored as chemical and electrical data in the brain and the nervous system. Then when decision time comes, the whole system just kind of turns the crank, mechanistically brings up a choice with nothing but chemistry and electrical signals. Those Stephen Hawking quotes from last week are relevant again here. He says, "It's hard to imagine how free will can operate if our behavior is determined by physical law. So it seems that we are no more than biological machines and that free will is just an illusion." Another place he says, the reason that we say that humans have free will is because we can't predict what they will do. It's a really complicated machine, so we call it agency. Right? Imagine a Plinko board. You know Plinko? You know what I'm talking about? The big pegboard, you drop the coin in and it kind of bounces through. Imagine a Plinko board with 2 billion pegs and 1 million options. You drop the coin in, that's not free will. To Stephen Hawking, on secularism, that's kind of the best we can do. That's the best, closest thing to free will that secularism can come up with. We just don't understand where it's going to land. So if secularism is true, then your decisions are merely chemical reactions and electrical signals. Your free will is an illusion. Okay, jumping into meaning. It's about 11. So I'm going to go ahead and wrap up. I'm going to keep going. But if you need to take off, please feel free to. Sorry about that. It'll be on our podcast. So if you want to finish it out, it'll be up there in a little bit. Okay, meaningfulness of action. Your blank there is morality. Morality. Meaningfulness of action. So after we become aware of ourself, after we become aware of our ability to act in a limited sense outside of the chain of cause and effect, we become aware that there is a certain rightness and wrongness to various actions. It's not all just wiggling the balloon. What I do with my freedom matters. So basically, there's two kind of vectors of meaningful action. First is dignity. Dignity or rights. Right, there are certain things as a distinct self. There are certain things that others must not do to me. There's a certain sense of dignity, but then also there's a certain sense of duty or responsibility. As a distinct self, there are certain things that I am obliged to do. There's a certain rightness to things I must do and a certain wrongness to things I must not do. This is, again, basic to the human experience. Secularism can only account for these intuitions within the limits of materialism and mechanism. Materialism and mechanism. If there's no real nature, if there's no universal human nature, there's no universal rightness and wrongness to actions. So secularism, the secular account of morality boils down to evolution, herd, survival, and society. Society. In the deep history of time, so the story goes, there was a raw and amoral herd of humans roaming the plains. Then some subgroup happened to develop some moral scruples. It's bad to kill each other. It's bad to sleep with someone else's wife. It's bad to take things that are in somebody else's cave. For no good reason, just kind of develop these. And somehow these scruples happened to give this group a survival advantage. And so this now moral herd of humans had a survival advantage over the other amoral humans, and that propagated. There's a certain survival value to these things. And then Rousseau and Freud, around the dawn of the Enlightenment, basically came to see morality as basically a way that we trade our individual happiness for social harmony. We trade away a little bit of my individual autonomy to choose whatever I want to do in exchange for broader social flourishing. Before social norms, men and women were amoral, free, happy, but chaotic and unstable. So we act in certain ways and not others as a kind of social contract. And then Marx, of course, adds the element of oppression, that morality is basically a way for the powerful to oppress the weak, which gets us to our kind of modern state of this expressive individualism. The height of human flourishing is to throw off these moral obligations so that you can actually have that kind of pristine human freedom that was so lost in the dark ages of history. So on evolution, morality is no more transcendent than taste. Most people like coconut, but some, the more refined palates, don't. I don't like coconut. There's nothing better or worse about that, right? Some like coconut, some don't like coconut. That's okay, that's taste. Who cares? Just kind of a fluke of genetics. On secularism, on the secular worldview, most people don't like murder, but some don't mind it. Some aren't too bothered. What's the difference? Just kind of a fluke of genetics. Just a taste. I find it distasteful. At a societal level, the preferences of the majority are the final judge of morality. If society decided to condone murder and outlaw marriage, there'd be nothing above that. There'd be nothing above that opinion. So here's the argument. If secularism is true, especially relativism, nominalism, and skepticism, then moral duties and responsibilities are illusions. On some accounts, oppressive illusions. There are no such thing as good people and bad people. So this is again kind of one of the main objections that you might get here is someone might say, so are you saying that atheists can't be good people? And no, that's not at all what we've been talking about. The argument is that if atheists are right, then the labels good people and bad people are completely meaningless. There's no such thing as good people in the first place. There's no such thing as bad people in the first place. All that those labels could possibly mean is these are people I like and those are people I don't like. If secularism is true, it's just taste. It's just preference. Mediated through society, mediated through genetics, but it's just taste. If secularism is true, then all your moral praise and indignation, all of your they can't do that, as well as all your deepest seated senses of duty are nothing more than taste and personal preference, coupled with social pressure. Morality is an illusion. Okay. Number four, meaningfulness of life. So meaningfulness of action, now meaningfulness of life. So we're thinking here about kind of origin, purpose, and destiny. Origin, where'd we come from? Purpose, why are we here? Destiny, where are these things moving towards? So we start to root the meaningfulness of our actions in the broader meaningfulness of life taken as a whole. So we begin to sense that our lives are in some sense a part of a story. We sense that the past matters, that we're entering into something. We sense a deep longing for our lives to count, to be meaningful for something. Over time, our choices in life get more and more shaped by a sense of what is and is not meaningful. Our decisions start to be guided by a sense of story. Where have I come from? Why am I here? Where am I going? We choose a major in college based on what we think is meaningful. We get married or not. We get married at what age or not, based on what we find meaningful. We have kids or not, and how many kids, based on what we find to be meaningful. So we sense that life is meaningful, and we work really hard to, one, discover that meaning, and two, live in alignment with that meaning. This is, again, basic to the human experience. There's an origin. What's already happened? What's happening at the beginning of the story? Where'd all this come from? There's a present in the story. What's going on now? What's the situation we're currently in? There's a destiny. What's the end point? Where is all this going? How does this turn out? Or at least, what are the different options? So here's the argument. If secularism is true, especially nominalism, skepticism, and mechanism, then life, your life, and the entire universe is fundamentally and comprehensively meaningless. All meaning is made up. No more truly meaningful than a kid playing make-believe in the backyard. He might think of himself as a great hero, but it doesn't matter. On secularism, we come from nothing. We are in our current situation by random chance and go to nothing. On secularism, our origin, the universe has no maker or designer, and it kind of pulled itself into existence for absolutely no reason. The earth was formed for no reason, out of pure random chance. Life came into existence for no reason, with no design, no purpose, no direction. Humanity came to be for no reason, with no design, no purpose. You are from nothing, of nothing, for nothing, and to nothing. What's our present state? We're in our present state of circumstances for no governing reason, with no end in mind. All the history of nations and empires is fundamentally random. There's no meaning or purpose behind any of it. The Babylonian conquest, the Greek victory at Marathon, the conquests of Alexander the Great, the conquests of both Rome and the gospel, the triumph of the Allies over the Axis, all of it meaningless, random, unguided. What's our destiny? Extinction and the vast death of the solar system. Heat death, entropy. I want to read Bertrand Russell's full quote. I mentioned some of this last week, but I want to fill in the middle part that I skipped last time. He says this, that man is the product of causes which had no prevision of the end that they were achieving, that his origin, his growth, his hopes and fears, his loves and his beliefs are but the outcome of accidental collocations of atoms, that no fire, no heroism, no intensity of thought and feeling can preserve an individual life beyond the grave, that all the labors of the ages, all the devotion, all the inspiration, all the noonday brightness of human genius are destined to extinction in the vast death of the solar system, and the whole temple of man's achievement must inevitably be buried beneath the debris of a universe in ruins. All these things, if not quite beyond dispute, are yet so nearly certain that no philosophy which rejects them can hope to stand. Only within the scaffolding of these truths, only on the firm foundation of unyielding despair, can the soul's habitation henceforth be safely built. Again, he's one of those guys who's trying to live in that inhuman pole of let's take our secular convictions seriously. What does that mean? We have to first evacuate all meaning from everything. On that despair, that's where we have to start, says Russell. We come from nothing. We are nothing. We're destined for nothingness. On the Christian worldview, identity, agency, morality, and meaning, your most basic convictions about what it means to be human are actually true. You actually exist. You actually have real agency. Your actions actually do matter. There is a real norm against which your actions can be judged. There is a story. There is a meaning. There is a true origin, a true purpose, a true destiny. You exist in God's story. This world was created by God's word and power for his purposes. This world has fallen into sin, and God works in it to redeem the world, to save a people for himself. Today, he's building his church and rebuilding the world, and he invites you into this work. There's real meaning for you if you'd step into it. There's a glorious end coming where God finishes his work and recreates the world in power. Your most basic intuitions are correct. Your most basic sense of what it means to be human is true. You are a creature in God's cosmos, not an illusion in a meaningless sea of chaos. Not an illusion. So if secularism is true, here's kind of the argument fleshed out, then identity, freedom, morality, and meaning are all illusions. Identity, freedom, morality, and meaning are, in fact, not illusions. Therefore, secularism must be false. So, this is, we're well over time. Okay, I have some honorable mentions for you there. Some other things we could have talked about. Love, if secularism is true, love the deception. Thought, if secularism is true, thought is impossible. Mental states are not physical states. And last, there's this is-ought tension that would be interesting to dig into someday. Fact versus ideal. Humor, tragedy, and hope all exist in the sense of what should be the ideal versus what is the present reality. There's no form. If there's no form, then these three things are illusions. Okay, that's all I have. Very high level. If you missed any blanks, there's answer keys up here. Again, if you want to dig a little bit deeper, there's some books up here that I might recommend. Anyways, let me pray for you, and that will be all.